Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with Alan Shipton, editor of the autobiography of one of New Orleans' great musicians, Danny Barker, A Life in Jazz, and Gwen Tompkins, host of Music Inside Out, who wrote the introduction to this gorgeous new edition. And I'll have a look back at the literary year. It's a great pleasure to welcome these two guests to The Reading Life to talk about a fabulous new book from the Historic New Orleans Collection. It's a new edition of A Life in Jazz by New Orleans music icon Danny Barker. British scholar Alan Shipton is the editor of this book, which was originally published 30 years ago, and Gwen Tompkins of WWNO's Music Inside Out wrote the new introduction. The book is a beauty, lavishly illustrated, lovingly put together. Gwen, welcome.
Thank you. So glad to be here.
Oh, Alan, it's so great to have you too.
It is wonderful to be back in New Orleans after such a long time. I haven't been here for 14 years, and it's just great to
be back. Well, it has been too long then. So tell me a little bit about the original book.
Well, I first met Danny in 1976 when I was over for Jazz Fest, and I didn't really know him at that point, just literally met him, and that was that. And then in 1984, Trevor Richards, who's a drummer, English guy who lived for a long time in New Orleans and played drums and had lessons from Zooty Singleton, really into the music in a big way, came over to Europe and he said, look, you're a publisher, which I was at that point. He said, Danny's got all this stuff, and unless somebody does something with it, it's never going to turn into a book, and he would like it to, and he's had lots of rejections. It hasn't really worked for him, so can you come and help? So next time I was in New York, I flew down and spent some time with Trevor, and we met Danny, who was, I think, very defensive for natural reasons, because obviously he hadn't managed to get the stuff published as he wanted it up until that point. So I went to his house, and his house was like sort of fairly small wooden box, entirely full of paper. It was just extraordinary. There were boxes and boxes and piles of legal pads, bits of notepaper, typescript, photographs. And it became pretty clear that one of the impediments to making the book was that he just couldn't get to grips with organizing this stuff, because just as he did, more came in.
Of course.
So we spent a long weekend together just sorting it. And we didn't get through more than a bit of the room, but we found a lot of stuff. And that was the genesis. So we made one pile of autobiographical stuff, which is what became A Life in Jazz, and another pile of his stuff about Storyville, about New Orleans in the wider sense, about folklore and legend, and his own researches with musicians. And that became a separate book, which came out, sadly, after his death, but as my debt to Danny, it came out too.
Ah. So how long did you work on the original edition, and what was the reception like when it finally was published?
Well, two good questions. The first bit was, it was about 2 years, but that was partly because I couldn't be in the United States all the time I was in England. But on the other hand, being a sporadic visitor gave me the chance to set little deadlines for Danny. So we might find that in addition to the very finished chapters, there were things that we wanted to work on together to basically fill the gaps in the story. Mm-hmm. And he would work on those while I was away, and then we'd get back together and we read almost every word of this book aloud to each other, because that's how I think we managed to capture so much of the rhythm of Danny's voice in the book.
Oh, absolutely. I could hear his voice reading this book.
So that was the first thing. And then the reception was great, because I think at that point, 1986, there weren't that many new autobiographies of musicians coming out. It was something that Danny really prompted me to do, and I started a series of which this was one of the first ones. And that's up now to well into double figures of,
right.
of books, not all edited by me, but published by me, of mm-hmm. that generation of musicians whose stories, as Danny said, would otherwise be lost. And so that was the motivation. So this was very well received, and I think particularly from people who'd seen little bits of Danny's writing in things like Hear Me Talking to You, or had looked at the book he did with Jack V. Berkley called Bourbon Street Black, which really doesn't have much of Danny's voice in it. Uh-huh. So this suddenly became the book that everybody knew he'd been working on but hadn't actually arrived.
Finally. You know, there are a lot of books like that in New Orleans lurking in people's houses, really. So Gwen, here you come all this time later. And you write the introduction. So what's it like for you to read that book then and now and evaluate it for us?
Oh, you know, that book really stands up. I mean, we wouldn't be sitting here if the book didn't stand up, right? You know, it gets better. The more times that I read it, the more I fall down this wormhole, you know, mm-hmm. in time. And to begin with Danny Barker, you know, born in 1909, and he's telling stories not only from his childhood, but from interviews that he's had with musicians who were older than he. So his stories date back really to the turn of the last century, and then they move forward to the end of the 20th century. And what's fascinating about the reading is that, A, as you've said, how engaging it is, and as Alan has described, how engaging the reading is. I mean, you want to know more about this guy. You want to know more about all of his friends. You want to know all about the people he loves. And, you know, the best memoirs, I find, are the ones in which someone wants to tell you, hey, this is what I love, and yes, I want to share it with you. You know, mm-hmm. not score settling, not, oh, me, I'm so great.
Yeah.
<You know? laughs> But well, look at him. Look at them. Look at this other thing. Listen to that. That's great. You see? Mm-hmm. And so for Danny Barker, he was 76 years old when he got this book deal.
Yeah.
76. So he'd been working on this book for 76 years.
Well, that's the great virtue of living a long and good life, you know? You really have the stories to tell.
It's true. And coming from New Orleans, you know, anything that marinates that long is probably going to be pretty good or pretty awful. I mean, in this case, pretty great.
Well, there's this incredible feeling you get when you read it. It's like he was present at so many marvelous moments. He seems to have known everyone who mattered by virtue of that long career.
That's absolutely right.
Yeah, I think he's one of these people who was an observer. The wonderful photograph on the front of the new edition by Milt Hinton.
Yes.
Danny's looking at you. If you go into a bookstore and you see this book looking out at you, his eyes follow you around the room. And that's sort of what Danny did in life. He describes himself somewhere in the book as a fox, and the fox looks, observes, and then takes his pick of things. And that's Danny watching the jazz scene evolve, watching the whole era of African-American consciousness evolve. He is very forthright about experiences, so there's a dreadful story in there about going to Mississippi as a young man and playing and being taken to perform for the owners of a bloodhound center, and the bloodhounds are used to track down African-American convicts. And the terror that must have been in a boy who was only just out of his teens playing for these people who were ruthless killers, basically. It's extraordinary. And one of the amazing things the collection have done is to find pictures of the place, the people, the kennels. I mean, I thought this was partly fiction. Seeing it here, you realize Danny's actually toned it down from the reality.
Well, it reads like a thriller when you read that chapter. You're thinking, oh my God, I know he got out of this, but how is that possible? I mean, really, it was a terrifying thing to read.
One of the things I felt when I first looked at the manuscripts was that this is no ordinary writer. Had he had a different walk of life, he could have been a very great writer, I think. And there are a few set-piece chapters in this book. Annie Mule Hall, The Pine Cindered Sovereign State of Mississippi, that one, The Dixies, about that bloodhound kennel, and some of the later stuff about Jelly Roll Morton, the portraits of this very eccentric musician, which clearly he called Danny Hometown. There was a lot of affection between the two of them. And those, I think, are so beautifully written, so finely wrought, that this is literary craft of the highest order.
I love that other photograph of Milt Hinton's of Dizzy Gillespie and Danny Barker asleep on each other's shoulders on the train. He was very photogenic. But I want to have you talk about what you learned that perhaps you didn't know from Danny's up close and personal view of these figures. What did he see that other people might not have seen about them?
You know, it's interesting that you should bring up Dizzy Gillespie, because Danny Barker saw in Dizzy Gillespie what many of his bandmates in the Cab Calloway band did not see in Dizzy Gillespie. They thought of him as sort of a young fella, sort of an upstart whose way of playing was not necessarily similar to their own. You know, they saw him as someone who was upsetting the apple cart to some degree. And in the book, Danny Barker says, you know, I didn't think he was Dizzy at all.
Which is such a great line.
It is.
And he gives a wonderful assessment of what he thought to be Dizzy Gillespie's talents, you know what I mean, at that phase of his career and his life, and what he brought to the band that perhaps made the band better. Mm-hmm. And also why ultimately Dizzy Gillespie had to leave that band, you know, in order to become what he was destined to become.
He also seemed to have a really strong sense of what it took to make a band work. What kind of human energies it took from different people to keep going. And he was very observant about getting work for his friends, thinking who would fit in where, wasn't he?
I think the thing that I got most from him talking about the music itself was his observations about the other big bands of the swing era. I'd never listened to John Trueheart, who was the guitarist with Chick Webb. But Danny said, if you want to hear a really interesting rhythm guitarist, you check out those records. And he's absolutely right. He talks about various drummers having the ability to change the sound of a rhythm section. And again, Jimmy Crawford, he said, could shade a band like nobody else. Mm-hmm. Now, you've got to be fairly into your record collection and know about the music for that to mean something. But the minute you start listening, everything he says makes sense. And so it's not just a question of bringing these characters to life on the page, but it's also putting them in their musical context in such a way that when you go to listen, suddenly everything stands out in three dimensions in a way that it wouldn't do if you just listened to the records and thought, well, yeah, that's a kind of a swing rhythm section. And for me, the biggest lesson was to learn about the Calloway band. Mm-hmm. I'd written Cab Calloway off. I mean, most English jazz critics couldn't stand him. They thought he was just a kind of vaudeville singer who happened to have a band with some good musicians in it who never got a chance to play properly. Because the whole social environment of the English jazz critic was the Record Society, where you listen to solos and you say how great somebody is. And they don't get much of an opportunity on a Cab record because he's there. But when you listen to the band, the brilliant arrangements, the way the rhythm section unfailingly swings, Danny not only told me about that, but we spent evenings on his porch in Sear Street as the sun went down listening to these records on his old gramophone. Not a wind-up gramophone, they were LPs, uh-huh. But we were absolutely into the music. And he would say, listen to the way Cab puts this song over. And he used to say, Cab had great pipes. That was his great thing about Cab. But, and he says that in the book. But he loved the way that Cab could inhabit a song and tell a story. And so, and although loads of the stories are about Minnie the Moocher, there are others that Cab could really inhabit and tell. And Danny felt that this was something that if you missed, you were missing a massive slice of 1930s entertainment.
Well, I'm curious to know how you both would rank this book, for example, in the great list of New Orleans music books. I mean, I think of Satchmo, My Life in New Orleans, as one of the great African-American autobiographies. I mean, Armstrong was a writer. You know, he traveled with a typewriter, you know, wrote those letters, made those collages, did those incredible things. How do you think Danny Barker's memoir measures up?
I think it's eloquent and often elegant reportage.
Very nice.
That's what I think, you know, because oftentimes Danny is not the lead character in his stories.
Uh-huh.
You know, he's observing and he's relaying who you, the reader, should be paying attention to if you care about this music.
Well, when I was interviewing Michael Tisserand about his Crazy Cat book, we talked about how artists are scholars of their art form as well as performers, you know, and that's certainly true of Danny Barker with all those pages and pages of notes and interviews, isn't it?
Yes, I think I go along with everything Gwen's just said about Danny, and I think you're dead right about the interviews. The other thing that I think is really important to say about this book and where it differs from Armstrong is if you go back to this whole idea of the West African griot. One of the things that Alex Haley brought out when he was talking about roots is the ability of the griot to recall generations of history. I mean, it's a bit like Aboriginal Australians remembering the landscape. In West Africa, it was remembering your family, and particularly that was important for families that had been broken up, disrupted, and completely destroyed by slavery. So Danny gives us these hierarchies. One of the great things about the early part of the book is all the families, the Barbara family, the Barker family, Louise's family. So there's all that different information about the generations that came before. And I think that in addition to everything else, and the reason for me this is one of the great New Orleans books, is that it puts Danny at the focal point, almost at the axis of a seesaw. You've got the past on one side, and then the weight comes down firmly on the present, but with all that knowledge about what's gone on in the past. And this is what allowed him to train a new generation and to bring the music alive for younger people.
In the Fairview Baptist Church Band, yes.
It's true. He creates this amazing diorama, you see. But at the same time, he never ventures far from his original notion about music, which is that it is an intimate experience. You know, he often describes it between a man and a woman, you know.
But well, that, like you said in the introduction, he's not afraid to work blue. I mean, he never was.
No, and that's what makes me love him, actually, you know.
Oh, well, it's a magical, magical book, and I hope lots of people pick it up and take it to heart. We've been talking with Alan Shipton, editor of A Life in Jazz by Danny Barker, and Gwen Tompkins, who wrote the introduction to this beautiful new edition. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
For me, every year is a good year in Louisiana books, but this year seemed particularly rich. There was a lot to celebrate. For starters, Shakespeare's 400th birthday. Tulane University hosted the first folio, complete with a second line for Shakespeare in April at Tulane, and then a band of Tulanians traveled to Stratford to second line for the bard in his birthplace. And I think we can take civic pride in Bob Dylan's Nobel Prize. After all, a good bit of his book Chronicles takes place during his time in the Crescent City. And Bob Dylan is the one who wrote, "In New Orleans, everything seems like a good idea." And, "There are a lot of places I like, but I like New Orleans better. Come on back, Bob, any old time." As always, festivals were a high point of the literary year. A new festival made its debut this year. Megan Burns and Bill Lavender co-founded the New Orleans Poetry Festival, held in April. Plans are well underway for 2017's festival, which will take place April 21st through 23rd. Two great traditions are in the making: performances by poets with bands, one of the best ideas ever, and a grand finale reading at the Maple Leaf Bar. Then in September, Dillard University hosted the Black Arts Movement Festival, featuring Ishmael Reed, Haki Madhubuti, and Askia Toure, leading lights of the Black Arts Movement, and a whole host of African-American scholars. September brought that gigantic gathering of mystery writers and fans, BoucherCon, to New Orleans. The Diana Pinkley Prizes for Crime Fiction this year went to Sarah Paresky for her distinguished body of work, 19 novels featuring Chicago PI V.I. Warshawski, and Christine Carbo for her debut novel, The Wild Inside. The grand old festivals marked significant anniversaries this year. Tennessee Williams New Orleans Literary Festival celebrated its 30th year in March, with headliners Mary Badham, who played Scout in To Kill a Mockingbird, and Estelle Parsons, among others. Words and Music, a literary feast in New Orleans, marked 25 years in November, bringing noted Mexican journalist Jorge Hernandez to town for the big read of Sun, Stone, and Shadows, his landmark anthology of Mexican short fiction. The 13th Louisiana Book Festival in Baton Rouge honored New Orleans historian and biographer Christina Vella with the Louisiana Writer Award. The New Orleans Book Festival in City Park and the New Orleans Book Fair in Clouet Gardens rounded out the year. One Book, One New Orleans continued its great work this year with the selection of The Baby Dolls, Challenging the Race and Gender Barriers of the New Orleans Mardi Gras Tradition by Kim Vaz DeVille of Xavier University. What a difference Kim has made in our community with this groundbreaking scholarship. The indie book scene got a lift this year with the addition of the beautiful new bookstore, the French Library on Magazine Street. And publishing got something new with Crescent City Books' new publishing imprint. The books published this year were diverse and plentiful. In mysteries, there were lots of new series entries from old favorites, Nevada Barr, James Lee Burke, Greg Heron, Bill Lofelm, Gene Redman, and a second noir novel from Michael Alenzel, who's rapidly becoming a new favorite. debut literary fiction was also wonderful, with work from Peyton Burgess's The Fry Pans Aren't Sufficing, which gets the award for unforgettable title, Matthew Griffin's exquisite story of a closeted gay couple, Hyde, and Nicholas Maneri's The Infinite, which moved between post-Katrina New Orleans and the Mexican drug wars. It was a breakout year for Yuri Herrera with his Transmigration of Bodies, which received international acclaim. Katie Simpson Smith solidified her ever-growing reputation with an unforgettable second novel, Free Men. John Gregory Brown's story of redemption, A Thousand Miles from Nowhere, was one of the year's best reads, along with Robert Olin Butler's Perfume River. Adrienne Van Young's Shadows in Summerland was a spooky tale of spiritualism behind the scenes. And I can't leave out that wonderful anthology, Monday Nights, stories from the Creative Writing Workshop at the University of New Orleans, edited by Frederick Barton and Joanna Leek, celebrating 25 years of the UNO Creative Writing Workshop. Gorgeous picture books were everywhere. Susan Tucker's City of Remembering, A History of Genealogy in New Orleans was a gorgeous tour of the past. John Kemp surveyed 37 landscape artists and expressions of place, the contemporary Louisiana landscape. Peggy Scott Laborde and Lewis Hodges explored some memorable moments in the fairgrounds through the lens. Rulak Toledano and Scott Veazey rescued the legacy of artist Martha Wright Ambrose. And River Road Publishing made a splash with Simone of New Orleans by Yvonne Perrette, a tribute to the work of Simone Hardeveld. Today's guest, Gwen Tompkins, wrote the introduction to A Life in Jazz by Danny Barker, edited by today's guest, Alan Shipton. Photographer Philip Gould and writer Herman Fuselier joined forces for the beautiful Ghosts of Good Times, Louisiana Dance Hall's Past and Present. And artist Alex Beard created one of the most elegant books I've ever seen, A Brush with Nature, Abstract Naturalism and the Painting of Life. There were notable poetry debuts by Ricky Laurentis, Clint Smith, Nicole Iden, Andrea Panzica, along with wonderful new books by already established poets Alison Pellegrin, whose new book was Waterlines, and Carolyn Hembree, author of Rigging a Chevy into a Time Machine and Other Ways to Escape a Plague. Significant nonfiction came along, too. Erin Greenwald continued her exploration of the Company of the Indies. Nigel Hamilton continued his multi-volume biography of Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And Patrick Maney gave us a brief and insightful biography of Bill Clinton. The story of Dan Bright, Crime, Corruption, and Injustice in the Crescent City, written by Dan Bright and Justin Noble, told the jaw-dropping story of a man unjustly convicted of murder, while John DeSantis chronicled the Thibodeau Massacre. Longshot, A Soldier, A Senator, A Serious Sin, An Epic Louisiana Election, by Tyler Bridges and Jeremy Alford, told a great tale of Louisiana politics. Anne Boyd Rue's standout work of scholarship, Constance Fenimore Woolson, Portrait of a Lady Novelist, earned front-page treatment in the New York Times Book Review. Watch for her next book, A History of Louisa May Alcott's Little Women. I'm grateful to Anne for taking me back to that childhood favorite. Laura Naughton's unflinching memoir, The Jaguar Man, gave us all a model of human compassion. Novelist, memoirist Jessamyn Ward, inspired by James Baldwin, edited the landmark anthology, The Fire This Time, A New Generation Speaks About Race. And LSU professor Nancy Eisenberg made bestseller lists with White Trash, A History of Class in America. As the year ends, we see the New Orleans regulars out with new candidates for the bestseller list. In The Undoing Project, A Friendship That Changed Our Minds, Michael Lewis chronicles the friendship of Israeli psychologists Daniel Kahneman and Amos Tversky, and their influential insights into the process of decision-making. And Anne Rice takes her most famous character to fascinating new places in Prince Lestat and the Realms of Atlantis. I went to many readings this year, but two of them will stay with me forever. Family and friends turned out in droves to hear the poet Clint Smith read from his first book, Counting Descent. If you haven't heard one of Clint Smith's inspiring TED Talks, do yourself a favor and listen in. And the year ended on a real grace note, with Michael Tisserand's long-awaited Crazy, George Harriman, A Life in Black and White, the story of the New Orleans native who created Crazy Cat. This is my pick for best local book this year. Tisserand, who has already brought us such fine works as Kingdom of Zydeco and Sugarcane Academy, offers a star turn in this biography. It's a love story of comics and newspapers, And it's also a story of American idiosyncrasy and racial prejudice, a provocative tale of one man's secret life. What did Tisserand value about his subject? His sense of wonder and delight. And that's something the readers of this book will share too. And that's the last page for now. So until next year, until next week, keep reading. Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Room 220 presents readings by poets Lauren Levine, author of The Braid, and Elizabeth Gross, author of Dear Escape Artist, Sunday, January 1st at 5 p.m. at Antenna Gallery, 3718 St. Claude Avenue. The Monday Night Writers Group meets Monday, January 2nd at 7 p.m. at Barnes & Noble Metairie. The New Orleans-based live arts magazine Antenna, Signals issue number 4, is now accepting submissions of short works of fiction, nonfiction, poetry, and prose on the theme of terra formation, working the elements of a creative practice. Each written piece must be 1,500 words or fewer. They will accept up to 10 for inclusion in the next issue. Each accepted submission will also receive a small honorarium. For questions, email Imani, I-M-A-N-I, at antenna.works. The deadline is January 10th. The Women's National Book Association is holding its annual writing contest with 4 awards in the following categories: fiction, creative nonfiction, and poetry. The contest is open for submissions until January 15th. For more information, go to wnba-books.org. Submissions are open until January 15th, and the winners will be announced May 1st, 2017. Plan now to attend Writers Resist, the New Orleans event in a national series of readings, a multi-author reading event designed to inspire activism and community. Sunday, January 15th at 2 at the Art Garage, 2231 St. Claude Avenue. For more information, check out writersresist.org or the Writers Resist New Orleans Facebook page. Reading Big Fat Books for Fun begins its 6-week reading of the Canterbury Tales, Monday, January 16th at 6 in Abita Springs. For more information about this group, email Susan Blaylock at Abita Blaylock, that's B-L-A-L-O-C-K, at gmail.com. And here's something really exciting coming up at Tulane University. The Living Library takes place Thursday, January 26th from 11 a.m. to 3, and Saturday, January 28th from 1 to 4 at the Lavin Burnick Center for University Life. The Living Library was started in 2000 at the Roskilde Festival in Copenhagen, Denmark, and was organized by a youth organization called Stop the Violence. It's a personal way to promote mutual understanding and break down barriers, real or perceived, within a local community. Here's how it works. Individuals volunteer to be books, and attendees become readers who check out a book, meaning they sit with the volunteer to hear their story. If you'd like to volunteer to tell your story, check out LibGuides, that's L-I-B-G-U-I-D-E-S, .tulane.edu/livinglibrary. And don't forget, as you consider your New Year's resolutions, make the literary life a part of them. Support your local independent bookstores. We are blessed with many of them, and almost all of them offer reading groups and author appearances. Literary festivals and literacy programs are all in need of volunteers. Friends of the New Orleans Public Library and Friends of the Jefferson Public Library are all doing good work. And if you want to write, now is a great time to join a writing group or take one of the many great creative writing courses around the city. Make this year your year of reading. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.